Welcome to The Study. I'm Craig Robertson, bringing you programs dedicated to the life of the mind. This program is the second and concluding part of an interview with Vic and Olga Gostin. Vic tells us how he came to make his discovery of the origin of hitherto mysterious rocks in the Flinders Ranges as ejecta from the massive Lake Ackerman meteorite impact site. And Olga tells of her career in anthropology and gives us a moving account of the historic handover of the remains of Mungo Laney in 1992. And we also find out a bit about how the study works with two people in the house concentrating on their work.
Well, when I arrived in 1970, I was given carte blanche. Professor Rutland, my boss, said, "Well, Vic, you're the first sedimentologist in that. Go and teach it. Teach your subject. We want to know more about history of sediments, how to interpret the past." So I went, thanks to Brian Daly, who was the stratigrapher here, and he took me under his wing, and we went off to the Flinders Ranges, 1970, first trip, and it continued once a year, twice a year, field trips, about 2 weeks long, exploring the Flinders Ranges. Brian Daly was one of the students, along with Reg Sprigg and a few others, of Sir Douglas Mawson. So there was a directness, and all through the camp times, I remember the stories that would be told, I would get second-hand from Brian about his time with Mawson and what they did and how Mawson behaved. And that was exciting for me to get out into the bush, into the field. I enjoyed that very much. A very important incident occurred with us losing our axle. We broke an axle. We would always stop by at the Teague to let him know where we were heading, what we were hoping to do, so that he would know where we were about. He sent out his son, John Teague, who's now in charge of the same thing. John came out and with an axle, with all his gear, and replaced an axle in the middle of Bratchner Gorge for us. This is the service that these people did in those days. Just magical stuff. And so that was just a highlight of how you relate to the country people, how you relate to key people in the country in that sort of way and be helped by them. Fred Teague would also be monitoring. Oh, Mary Wade would be out here with Glazner. You know, she's collecting Ediacaran fossils. And so he'd just discovered by going to the toilet in Bratchner Gorge, apparently, that there were fossils of Ediacaran, not Ediacaran Hills, which are way up to the northwest, but actually in the Middle Ranges. So she found them, and all of a sudden the central Flinders opened up as the site for looking at the Ediacaran fossils. These Precambrian jellyfish and sea pens and blackworms and all sorts of fascinating things before the shellfish got going. So my interests part of the time was through in the Flinders Ranges, exploring them. But at the same time, what was drawing me was the Gulf. Nobody knew much. There was a little bit of some pipeline had been laid across from Mambre Creek through to the other side of the Gulf down to Wyala, the water pipeline from the Murray River. John Hales had arrived from England, and he was involved with oceanographic research there. He's a geographer with ocean interests and coastal interests. And he brought information with him about vibrocoring, equipment that could be put onto the seafloor from a ship and take cores of the seafloor sediment. And so we started a project in the late 70s, and it culminated in 10 years, basically, of marine research in the Iron Triangle, that we call, South Australians call the Iron Triangle, Wyala, Port Augusta, Port Pirie. That area of seafloor was crucial for environmental reasons, because of the shipping, because of the metal work, steelworks and iron works in Wyala, because of Port Pirie smelters, and previously radioactive sand treatments from Radium Hill and so on. A lot of pollution that already occurred. John Hales was put into the position of the first director of environmental sciences in Adelaide University. And I was his, effectively, geological sidekick. So together we put in proposals, we got grants, we got enough money to take to hire boats, to build A-frames for us, the Frederick G, a sort of old barge. And so we were able to, in the end of that project, do 300 kilometres of seismic profiling. And then separately we used the barge with the drilling to take about 330 vibrocores, plus some onshore cores as well, with Tony Bilperio. So this became a very comprehensive study, the most detailed one so far, of the upper part of Spencer Gulf. And that showed a fascinating historical path going back a few tens of thousands of years, maybe 200,000 years and so on, of sediment. Basically, the Gulf has been very shallow. It's been inundated every time we had a high sea level, and then sea level withdrew and soils formed. There are 7,000-year-old seagrass banks which are up to 7 meters thick. There's an enormous rate of build-up of carbonate shell grit, based shell grit with the seagrass holding it up in the top. But most of the Gulf was in a way disappointing because only had a half a meter, 1 meter, 2 meters here and there around the Gulf in the last few thousand years of marine inundation sitting on top of an old soil. And that ended up with a special issue of marine geology on Spencer Gulf, edited by Hales and Gostin, and with various chapters covering soils, covering sea level change, covering current directions and so forth. The very last vibrant core I took was in the middle of St. Vincent Gulf, the Gulf here in Adelaide, and we were able to show, together with John Cann, a Foran person, that in fact we had things which were 40,000-year-old sediments underneath, still wet, still sloppy, overlain by 9,000-year younger as the Gulf became inundated with the last rise of sea level. The Gulf, the recent Gulf of St. Vincent, only was inundated 9,000 years ago. We have a radiocarbon date for that in the middle of the Gulf. The part of the middle was in fact a saline lake. It never dried up totally. Must say that in the 70s, 76, I was invited and joined the deep sea drilling program, and leg 29 was the leg I was on, which did the mirror image, the parallel thing to the previous leg, which Larry Franks was on and in charge of, leg 28, which did the first Antarctic course around the edges of Antarctica. So we were kind of trying to complement and find out how and when Australia separated from Antarctica in its drift north. That introduced me to oceanography and ocean sediments, which is an entirely new thing, and I've never actually taught that. It's a new world. Ocean sediments are a different world. But that kind of was my oceanographic. Now, I never really got sea legs. I'm not a good sailor. So that gave me the interest in paleoclimates as well. That was a connection then between looking at ancient sediments with a focus. My PhD was on interpreting ancient ice ages in the marine context. And when I came to Adelaide, Brian Daly and I, when we went to Flinders, we looked at ancient ice ages. These ones were pre-Cambrian. So you had the ones with the Sturtian Ice Age, the big one that's in Sturt Gorge and then right through the Flinders, and then the Maranoa one, or the Alatna Formation, the Alatna Glaciation, which is the younger of the two major ice ages. I had many PhD students, of course, some of them looking at the deltaic, the interpreted deltas of the ABC Range quartzites, others looking at pound sandstones, others looking at limestones and so on. So I had a good feel for what was happening in the Flinders Ranges. And because of that, Richard Jenkins, a paleontologist, also a stratigraphist, and I went to Canberra and gave a talk in Canberra at one of the conferences, and we were approached afterwards by Bill Comston. Bill Comston and his group had just developed the SHRIMP. It's a S-H-I-R-P, for single crystal zircon dating, basically, to summarize. Bill Comston. So he came up to us and said, well, Richard Jenkins and Vic Gostin, you've been in the Flinders. Why don't you find some tuffs for us, volcanic rocks? We'll date them free. You know, we'll work together with you. Just send us some of your volcanic rocks and we'll try and give a date on these Flinders Ranges sediments, which we don't have any good dates on. So we came back enthused and so, well, with the promise of free dates, always excellent for geologists. And it was in that subsequent year that I stumbled, we had a student and we were told to watch out for tuffs because we get free dating, so we got some samples, excited because we found some volcanic rock at Pichirichi where we had a secondary field camp, and we had a beer over those, and that was fine. We sent off the samples and waited for the results. Meanwhile, Peter Haynes, who was a PhD student of Richard and mine, working in the central Flinders in Bunyarri Gorge, Braxton Gorge, came back saying, Vic, look at this block of volcanic rocks in the same level that you found at Pichirichi. This is amazing. We've got volcanic rock the size of these big bombs of the same material. And it's all in a layer. It's just, as you said, in the Bunyarri Formation. So that already expanded. So we started exploring and mapping out, and we realized that wherever the volcano was, it lay to the west of us and not to the east. Things petered out northwards, and the biggest blocks were around Bunyaroo and Brachin and sort of western part of the Flinders. But the dates came, and the dates were all wrong. I mean, 1,600 million years or thereabouts was very different than what we expected at 600 million years old. And so something was wrong. So we had to sort of look at again our records and why was this volcano dragging up this ancient dates up to the surface? And why weren't we getting any younger dates? So anyway, we puzzled over that for a while and tried to describe it and so on. And I was a sedimentologist, so it laid on me. I mean, Canberra had done 30-plus separate specimens of zircons. They dated 30, all right, you could dismiss a few of them. They came from the northeast of Flinders in a different stratigraphic position. But really, that at about $800 a pop in those monies, that was a lot of money that they spent on this false dating or uncertain dating in the Flinders Ranges. These two guys, Jenkins and Gostin, what was going on? So I had a rethink about that. See, well, is there any other way that things could form? And realize that perhaps it wasn't volcanic at all. It didn't match a glacial, because I'd studied glaciers, so it was definitely not glacial. It definitely didn't fall off a cliff made of the volcanic rock, because there weren't any cliffs of that material around anyway. It was a very different sort of volcanic rock to other tufs that were basaltic. This was acidic. This is all with quartz and dacite fragments in it. So it wasn't fluvial, because we're looking at a section 400 meters of shales and mud, fine muds. All of a sudden you have this coarse material up to the size of a football, and later on found double football size as well in the Flinders Range. So something's very wrong. So a huge volcano, had to have been really big. Volcanoes do give other tufts as well. And so one wondered, what could it be, anything else? Luckily, back in Melbourne University, I'd heard a lecture given about moon and about impacts on the moon. And the craters on the moon were not volcanic craters at all. They were meteorite impact craters. So I thought, well, hang on. Another thing that could have caused this layer of volcanic debris is meteorite impacting into a volcanic. And guess what? To the west of the Flinders Ranges lay the Gawler Ranges, made of identical material with identical age. 1,600 million year old ages in the Gawler Ranges. The Yardia dacites have been well dated. And here I had samples which they gave 1,600 million year old. So there was the coincidence. Not only that, because aerial photographs had been, satellite images had been taken, and Nick Lemon, Peter Haynes showed me a book called South Australia from Space. And they said, look, if you open up on this page, shows the Gawler Ranges, and there's a circular structure called Lake Acraman. And he said, George Williams, working for BHP at the time, maintains that he's been out to the lake, he's sampled material, he thinks that is an impact site. It's got crushed rock in the middle of it, and the circular structures around. So why don't you check with him? Now, George and I had gone to Melbourne University, he was just a year ahead of me, and they started working with BHP. So he was looking for the next Roxby Downs. And he explored Lake Acraman. Anyway, he got back samples, and so we compared the samples, and they matched. Now, we already knew that the ages were correct. The process of forming was correct, because you now have the whole story. The impact was discovered determined as an impact structure by George Williams. I and my friends had discovered and proved that we had not a volcanic event, but a datable or igneous rock was thrown there. The gradient of the thickness of the layer increased to the west, so everything lay in the right direction. And then, of course, you had to really prove it. This was the time of Alvarez and his son, who was showing that KT boundary had a lot of iridium, so we had to find somebody who could do some platinum and iridium analysis for us. There was a very expensive laboratory in Perth, but there was a guy called Reed Keyes, Melbourne University. And Reed was operating a platinum laboratory, which is ultra clean, parts per billion. So please, Vicky told me, take off your gold wedding ring, because it'll affect our readings. We don't want, when you sample, remove your ring and make sure your hands are clean and don't touch the rocks too much with your gold hand, because it'll show. So that's how sensitive the laboratory was. And that past pavilion then turned out, he phoned me afterwards saying, "Wow, it's high, you've got an anomaly." So that was kind of the confirmatory thing, that geochemical thing, which finally proved that, yes, our layer of volcanic rock wasn't due to a volcanic eruption, but due to a meteorite impact, which left its stain, its geochemical trace element stained on the debris that was thrown out from the meteorite impact. Well, in Diacaran, internationally, there was commissions and people came around, and they eventually decided, although it wasn't unanimous, the Russians still would like to see it up in the White Sea, the northern Russia as a type section. They chose Flinders Ranges. They chose the very top, the end of the second end of the glaciation, the Elapna, the Elapna glaciation. So the top of the Elapna tillites and glacial deposits became the Golden Spike, which then marked the base of the Diacaran period, which then lasted until the base of the Cambrian. So the Cambrian forms the top of the Diacaran period, and the base of it is at the Golden Spike, which is at the end of the Flinders Range, a major glaciation in the Flinders Ranges. The rich fossils are all in the upper part, and about halfway through, so you go through, after the glacial, you have a Nuccalina dolomite, it's a widespread cap dolomite, followed by the Brashina shales, followed by deltaic cycles. The ABC Range quartzites form deltas that spread out into the Flinders, and then that's followed by the Bunyaru formation, a shale, marine shale, 80 metres into which you have this ejector horizon, the meteorite impact. And lately, whilst we did know of these occurrences of odd pebbles here and there, which suggested to us ice rafting, we nevertheless just avoided them. We didn't bother about them. But now going back, we realise, hang on, they may be relevant to the whole story. And luckily, one of the students that Dave McCurdy had brought me some samples. She wanted me to look at the thin section from drill core in the Officer Basin. That's 400 kilometres to the west of the impact site. And these drill cores turned out to have what I described as till pellets. I mean, I had recognised these things, and Tom Ovenshine showed me his original paper from Alaska, where glaciers which make these little aggregates of till, moraine, which last, and which, when the ice melts, fall to the ground. So I recognised these till. I said, "You've got evidence for glacial rafting at the same level or just before the Ackerman ejector come in." So we therefore put together the paper, and that's the latest paper, that actually indicates now, hello, the impact occurred into a frozen landscape, or in a landscape which included glacial icebergs, sea ice and other episodes. So we've then basically said, well, there is evidence in Australia of a glaciation or a significant ice cover during that time. Not huge amount, but enough to create icebergs and enough to create sea ice that allowed isolated pebbles to be rafted in. And the impact occurred at that time. So we then know from Kath Gray's work in Western Australia, she's a West Australian paleontologist, she'd looked at the Officer Basin, and that extends up into Western Australia. She'd looked at the preservation of tiny microfossils, floating planktonic fossils, and she described them and saw that, in fact, there was a major abrupt change, that with the arrival of the Ackerman ejector, you then had a demise of various things. You had a sort of a starved interval, but followed by an enormous explosion of varieties of these microfossils. It looked as if there was some involvement then, one thing follows another, and that the combination, perhaps, this is only a suggestion, the combination of a glacial interval or a cold interval with an impact which disturbed the atmosphere and the hydrosphere. This impact, by the way, occurred when Australia was almost equatorial. So equatorial means that any effects are both hemispheric, north and south hemisphere, and therefore we then propose that it is the combination of a very cold interval which puts stress on the flora, marine biota, plus the impact which put further stress on the environment that would then lead to the explosion of these varieties of microfossils, and then of course the Diacaran multicellular forms occur towards the end of that. Macroforms, the multicellular ones, really only start to be higher up again. Without getting into the detail of the water, there are no macroforms. There have been strange discs found beforehand, and I'm looking at the literature now, and in fact, there are discs occurring even underneath the whole Ediacaran level. These discs may be fungi, not advanced forms of life at all, very simple forms, but nevertheless aggregated together into distinct shapes. There's more to the story to come, and there's also a geochemical isotopic story, and so Dave McCurdy, who's an organic geochemist, it was his student who brought me the material from Officer Basin that I identified the till pellets. And, they worked essentially on the carbon and oxygen isotopes through that and show major changes. So they see, they can document a time after the impact when you had almost an absence of fauna, and then a variety of things which are biologically not present before. By the way, the things that survived this crisis were ones that went through a cyst stage in their life cycle. So they're basically hibernating. They were the survivors, and then they then expanded. So it's an interesting time because we have their studies done around the world in different parts of this middle Ediacaran period. People have come in with exotic theories, and one of them suddenly arrived that, in fact, because you had low-latitude glacial at sea level, so we know that these icebergs floated in the sea, so you had ice coming down to sea level, but also within, say, 10 degrees latitude or 15 degrees latitude, so equatorial, basically. And around the world, as people have studied them, many others have turned out to be in a similar bandwidth. So the simple story would be, and some people came out with saying, well, equatorial ice, either it's not ice and you guys are all wrong, or we don't think we are, we think it is good evidence for ice, or the whole Earth became frozen. So the snowball Earth theory arose because of the preponderance of low-level, low-latitude, sea-level glacial events. But because many of us, we saw no evidence of total freeze-up. We saw evidence of continuing tidal movement, of seasonality, of summer, winter seasonality in the tidal cycles. We saw evidence of deep frost, of frost wedges, and wind-blown deposits on the shelf. So we saw a vast variety of paleogeographies, not including totally frozen Earth. And yet here we are, people are saying, well, it's all frozen Earth and so on. So we've always denied that. We've always seen. And continuously now in the last 10 years, I would say, bits and pieces of evidence, people are coming back and saying, well, maybe it wasn't total snowball Earth, maybe it was slush ball. But increasingly we're saying, well, maybe it's not even that. Yes, we did have episodes of cold near equatorial zones, but we always had areas of open water. And you need areas of open water to maintain your carbon cycle, your oxygen, your transfer of air and water and so on. So that's why those of us, not just myself, are totally against the idea of snowball Earth.
You're listening to The Study, and we're talking to Vic and Olga Gostin. We conclude these two programs with Olga's account of family life and her career as an anthropologist, particularly the events around Lake Mungo, and then with Vic and Olga on life in general.
After we married, the children came. Like many Australian families, I was the homemaker. Victor had to acquaint himself with South Australian geology, so he was away as much as he could be, and he was largely absent to the point that the children didn't even miss him if he wasn't in bed in the morning. Or Victor himself sort of became cognizant of his children when we were on study leave in Canada and we were camping, and the children were at that stage 7 and 9, and we're all in the tent together and the children are playing their usual games and talking, and Victor says, "These are very interesting people." Hadn't really gotten down to his kids because he was doing his geology. I may say that it's very different with the grandchildren because he's been a hands-on grandfather, and I'm delighted to see that he's personal enrichment of contact with little ones as they develop has all been there with the grandchildren, thanks to the generosity and the beauty of our daughter and her husband. So I was the homemaker, and it was a very interesting period because I got to know what Australian suburbia is about. We had lived always in the bush in South Africa, minus water, minus electricity, with animals, and didn't really socialize at all. And so it was a very interesting thing to find the typical Australian suburbia, where the street is your family, where people are in and out of each other's house. And because I didn't care one bit about furnishings and stuff, our house was the meeting place for children who wanted to turn the tents or cubby houses. I didn't care what they turned upside down. So the free-for-all was at our place. And conversely, though, the neighbors offered Australian songs and English literature, what books to read to children, because, of course, my background was French, so I didn't know anything about Christopher Robin and whatever else there is. So that was a very interesting period. And then by the time the youngest, Andre, was at school when he was six, I knew that I'm no model housewife. I was absolutely not interested in polishing and cleaning and all that. So I needed to go out, and it's actually Victor flying to Tasmania on one of his geological jaunts, who was sitting next to David Hogue. David was then the head of task force, and that was the first tertiary program for Aboriginal people in Australia. I joined task force, and my working life of 25 or 30 years was entirely with the Aboriginal task force. And in retirement, I'm an adjunct still with what began as a small program with an intake only of 25 students, with the idea of giving them 1 year only of sort of tertiary coaching so that they could be community development workers and get proper salaries. It developed into a diploma course, then a degree course, then a school of Aboriginal and Islander Administration, then the Unipen School, then a faculty, and now we have the David Unipen College of Indigenous Education and Research. So the thing has developed from a very small organization into an independent college with virtually all Indigenous academics and administrative, or the staff is virtually all Indigenous, and it's a source of great pride and delight that I'm still accepted and nurtured, I must say, by the group as sort of a resident fossil, and treated very kindly. And I'm very happy to be there, because with the absence of technologies in our house, it's wonderful to have access to the computer at university. The irony of all the situation back in the 1970s, early 70s, when I started at Task Force, was that many of the students were from the stolen generation. They came in by special selection, but we tested the students for literacy and numeracy over 3 days in Adelaide. And the irony was that there was a sort of inverted commas cultural vacuum, and over several decades really of apprenticeship, and with the help of very generous help of anthropologists from Adelaide University, I started up a course called Australian Ethnographies, which basically engaged with the diversity of cultures in Australia. Of course, you can't handle the whole lot of them, because there's at least 250 different languages and cultural groups, 600 if you take in dialects. But what I did was to look at ecological areas, and then you whittled it down to basically 11 major areas, like the Murray, Darling, Tasmania, the Western Australia, the monsoon areas, and so on. And so I presented to the students a sort of overview, a celebration of cultures. And that was very well received, at least for the first 2 decades. Towards the end of my career, students came in much younger, increasing number with secondary education, and also several had identified as Aboriginal fairly late in the bit, and they resented, frankly, the fact that they were here was a non-Indigenous person teaching an Indigenous subject. The resentment manifested itself in students basically saying that they couldn't and shouldn't be exposed to the to cultural knowledge of other groups. Now, I know enough about protocol and the propriety of cultures to know that one doesn't deal with sacred matters, but there is a lot of wonderful things in Indigenous diversities across Australia that you can handle, that you can share, that you can deal with without touching improperly on taboo subjects. But the students were purists, so they are what Victor, I think it was, coined cultural fundamentalists, that I was not to present the culture, a variety of cultures, to students who belong to other cultures. And so they basically started objecting to the subject, and I could see the writing on the wall. After all, culture belongs to people, and if there was that feeling, I switched basically from teaching Australian ethnographies to Indigenous people to teaching white students about cultures, in the sense that one of the policies of the University of South Australia as task force became, when the program started, it was the Aboriginal Task Force, and then the Institute of Technology became the University of South Australia, which had a mission statement that all students should be exposed to an Indigenous dimension. We have what we call service teaching to nurses, social workers, psychiatrists, lawyers, you name it. Incorporated into those subjects, into those courses, are subjects dealing with, specifically with Indigenous cultures. And so I was involved with every one of those subjects. So it was ironical to, from having started and having my tuition and learning from at the feet, as it were, of my students for 20 years who would take me aside. So I'm talking of the first two decades. The students who came, many of them were initiates, who taught me and shared me, and they said what was off record and on record of what I could and couldn't share with subsequent classes. From that situation to one of progressive narrowing and of fundamentalism till I gave it away, and then switched to white fellows who needed to engage with the first Australians in a respectful way. So that was the story. The Mungo story comes from the fact that when we started, the Indigenous students were drawn from all over Australia and really didn't knit very well at the start of the year, because they came from diverse backgrounds. We had from Kimberley, from the Top End, Torres Strait Islanders, urban people, all sorts. I felt the need to take them out of Adelaide and go camping and knit as a group so that people could relate to each other, share their cultural wisdoms, or if they were stolen generation, to address that and whatever. Mungo presented itself as a locality one day's drive away from Adelaide, an iconic place in terms of Jim Bowler's seminal research into the world's still oldest recorded cremation of an Indigenous woman, which had been dated at 35 to 40,000 years. I thought that to go to Mungo would be a good thing, and we did. We did it. In first year, we would go over a long weekend, and the students absolutely bonded as a group. And not only that, but of course, given the very open and respectful attitude that we had towards cultures always in the school, students very quickly said to me, well, we understand the archaeology, the importance of Mungo cremation, the burial and all of that, but where is the contemporary dimension? And I responded to that by seeking out from one of the three custodial groups, those are the Barkindji, the Nyampa and the Matimati. I got into contact with Matimati elder Mum Kelly, Alice Kelly, and thanks to that gracious lady, for the next two decades, really, either Mum Kelly or relatives would be come to us at Mungo, or we'd go to them at Balranald, and the students were able to connect with contemporary custodians. At Mungo, nobody is living. There's no community living there in permanence in this spectacular place. So that was the story of Mungo. Eventually, I wrote it up as part of my Masters of Environmental Studies. There were subsequent grants that came our way that I passed on to students, hoping that they would take the research further, but that didn't work out. So that's the Mungo story.
You were actually invited to the handover.
When the bones were returned, the remains were returned, it was very striking that it wasn't an archaeological happening. It was as if it were the returns of an aged granny coming back. And the sequence was quite extraordinary on that day, because I drove with Mum Kelly and Alan Thorne, who was holding the casket with Mungo Lady's remains in the casket, and Steve Webb was driving, and we were sitting in the car. And the newspaper shows, in The Age, they had a picture of Alan Thorne walking across the southern part of Mungo Lake, where originally Lady Mungo had been found. And he's there to hand over the remains to 12 elders who were sitting on chairs. And there's Mrs. Kelly had been very cognizant of the importance of the handover, so she had, in fact, children, a child at her feet, so that the child would be witnessed. And we were about 200 meters on the hill away from there. But what was so striking about that event is that after the handover, the casket went into the car, into the National Parks and Wildlife truck, and then we went under a canvas awning, and people made their speeches. Jim Bowler made his speech, and any people who needed to make their speeches. And then it was assumed that we would have a barbecue. And suddenly the barbecue wasn't taking place. The elders had sort of rounded up Alan Thorne and Jim Bowler and had taken them into the museum part of the Ranger's Place. The doors had been closed, and then smoke came out of the windows, and there was clearly a smoking ceremony. Of course, I'm on the outside. The elders were in there. And then after about an hour, Alan Thorne came out. Was it Alan Thorne? Yes. Alan Thorne comes out, and he was weeping. And I said to him, "Are you all right?" He said, "Yes, I simply cannot believe how what has happened." And he tells the story that basically the elders wanted, none of this is hidden or improper material, that the elders had wanted to understand what an archaeologist does with bones for such a long time, from 69 when they were found until 93 or 2, whenever they were returned. And so he had explained, he had put out the bones in the famous shoeboxes, as archaeologists do, and he had explained what the remains were, what sections of the skeleton, and so on. At the end of it, everything was packed back into the casket, which had two padlocks, and so he locked the padlocks, and he gave the keys to Mrs. Kelly, who was the representative elder, sort of the spokesperson. And Mrs. Kelly took one of the keys, and she took the other, and she gave it back to him. And she said, "You've been the custodian for X amount of years, and you have looked after her well. You have brought her back to us, and so you hold the key until we make a decision. You have asked me, well, how do I feel about it?" Opinions are diverse amongst Aboriginal people too, because there were some, as I could hear in the discussion later on, some who said that she should be re-cremated, cremation finished, others said that she should be buried where she was, others said, "No, let us have a keeping place where we can keep her." And in fact, some Indigenous leaders, Badger Bates, with archaeological training, was very well aware of the worldwide importance of these remains, and that they might well be kept in a keeping place. I must say, in relation to that, that John Mulvaney's autobiography, Digging Up the Past, has just come out, and he raises these issues about remains and very much speaks out his mind that these are worldwide, this is worldwide heritage. But what was so striking about that day at Mungo is that this was not an archaeological celebration. This was the return of Granny's bones. She was coming home. And this was absolutely drilled into us. in a totally informal way by the fact that afterwards, now I'm not sure about the sequence anymore. Did we have the barbecue or not? But in any case, we are asked then, so there's the smoking ceremony, Alan Thorne comes out, he's got a key, the others have a key. And then after, now I think we had the barbecue then, and after the barbecue we were all called up and told that the remains of Mungo Lady were on display. Now this is not the way I would have thought, oh wow, this is really a taboo. But the remains were on display. Well, the word probably wasn't display, but the remains were now laid out on the table in the ranger's office or wherever the place was in a room, and that we were to go in, no photographs allowed, of course, that we were to go in and preferably as adults take a child and lift the child so that the children can see Mungo Lady and remember as she has come home. This was not an archaeological do. This was a reverential coming home of the remains of someone. And 35,000 means nothing. I remember very well Lewis O'Brien, with whom I share a room now, a Ghana elder, with whom I've known over many decades, saying, oh yes, now we are 20,000 years old. Oh yes, but now a few years later, now we are 35. Oh, now we are 45. And then there was the Malakunanja, Rhys Jones discovered in the Northern Territory, and that was 54,000. And so he said, well, you white fellows keep on moving your dates, but for us it is forever. But forever means also that Mungo Lady is just passed and she's come home. That's what it was about.
The next question then is this whole issue about the relationship to the land. It's a question that's aggravated me all my creative life, I suppose. It's a very important central question to me personally. What do you think? And I'd like to know. You're married to a guy who's absolutely hands-on with the landscape as much as anyone in Western science can be.
Well, there's many, many aspects. Victor will give his input. First, I think we are dealing with stereotypes. And Aboriginal people are not exempt from stereotypes any more than we white fellows are. So when Aboriginal people say that we are not, whites are not connected to the land or don't treat the land or don't understand or connect to the land the way they do, that comes from an ignorance of understanding the bondage, the connections that you see in places in England, people with their Stonehenges, with their ley lines and so on, or in my heritage, the Ukrainian babushka, who, despite Chernobyl, insists on staying on her land. And you refer to the river as Matushka, and the land is called the Little Mother, and the river is also the Mother Volga, and so on. So all peoples have connections to the land. What is interesting, perhaps, what is at stake is how do white fellows in Australia, post-colonial people, connect to the land, or colonial, or whatever you want to call it, first settlement, 1788, connect to the land. And I think we have stereotypes both ways, in the sense that if you look at things metaphysically, Aboriginal people will say that, let me go back to environmental studies. When I was doing my master's in environmental studies and we were in the central, dealing with Central Australia and indigenous approaches to feral animals, as we call them, the camel, the rabbits, the whatnot, donkeys. And there are indigenous people who say, who would resist the culling and the elimination of particularly camels and donkeys. How can you eliminate your own dreaming? The animals of your dreaming, the camels, the three wise men came on their camels to see the Christ child. Christ entered Jerusalem on a donkey. And here you are out destroying your own dreaming from helicopters and leaving them to rot. This is not right. And not only that, but when it comes to other ferals, many, and one must be very careful not to generalize because everybody has got different opinions, but certainly that was one that came across then, that where creatures have birthed, I hope I'm not going into going across boundaries in referring to the fact that when the placenta mixes with the land, you have a bond by right, so that rabbits belong to the land. It doesn't matter where they came from. They are bonded. In the same way, we are also bonded. I describe in talk with women that some Greeks have the custom of taking placentas from hospital and burying them. People say, of course, we're all connected to the land. Now, if you take a person like David Tacy in his The Edge of the Sacred, there are several leading sociologists and thinkers in Australia who has openly spoken and have written about the fact that Australians will not find their identity until they express their bond with the land to include Indigenous dimensions. That spirituality, that connection with the land is there for us all to connect with. And Indigenous people are saying exactly the same. They are saying too, meet us, come and share our experience. This is what the Gama Festival is in the top end. This is what the Kimberley University is doing when it's asking Indigenous universities, asking people to come and experience their culture, connect with and become part of our experience. So at a fundamental level, I think we are all connected to this country, we're bonded with it, and if we would only listen to each other profoundly, and that goes from the two sides without prejudice, we would find that there is an absolute commonality, and people who have been here for two or more centuries have connection with the land and shouldn't apologize for feeling that, loving the country till it aches. I mean, you guys are going into it. What are you going to experience? You're going to have that visceral experience of the inland.
How do you feel about that sort of issue, Vic?
Oh, I feel that science and the scientific approach is perhaps just one part of the brain, one part of our attitude, one part of our response to the surrounding world. I mentioned my early and continuing interest in the arts and in seeing nature and trying to see patterns and trying to see colours and trying to see and represent nature. So the poetic, artistic, musical side I see is there, and I see that that also expresses something of our universe, that the universe isn't just made up of solid atoms and chemicals and rocks and fossils, but that it's also made up of relationships and attitudes and one's own mental. I believe, for example, very much in a mental world, in the newer sphere of Théâtre de Chardin, and the ability to communicate telepathically, the amazing way in which mothers and children are, and mothers know when their children have experienced traumas, when identical twins know what the other identical twin has experienced. I mean, to me, this is easily explained, that we don't quite know. We're starting to understand how the brain works. We're starting to understand all the magnetics, and we're starting to understand which parts of the brain do what, and how, in fact, the brain now is able to be correlated with a computer, so that we can actually think. There are people who can think through a certain thing and the computer works for them. So we're having, this is a very physical manifestation, but I think there's more to life than simply a very materialistic approach to it. So and I take it, I guess ever since I was a kid, and perhaps my mother helped me out through this by providing some literature along this way of other religions, other thought processes, and so on, that thinking that the thought world is an amazingly rich world that we have to be aware of and we can make use of. And the discoveries made simultaneously around the scientific discoveries made simultaneously around the world, to me, is no coincidence, because, in fact, those of us involved in some frontier research inevitably tap into and get our inspiration from this newer sphere of Tao Te Ching, or this mental, oh, that's a religious point of view, you might say. Well, be it as it is, but to me it's a reality. So the idea of the planet, perhaps we can come here now to Gaia and the idea of are we stressing the system? And I think we are. I followed James Lovelock. I accept many of his ideas, not necessarily all. All scientists will have some disagreement with every other scientist. But in general terms, that the Earth has been an amazing self-perpetuating, self-balancing system since the year it was founded. We've had water on the planet, it's never totally frozen, it's never totally evaporated. Our life has continued, we're all genetically tied back to some common root of some very hot fumarolic ocean depth slime. We are genetically related, we're an interrelated biota on this planet, and if we do find something on Mars, it may be related to us as well. So we have deep connections with all other living things. We are on a living planet, and to me that extends then to interest in planetology. So my interest in planetology and looking for life in other planets and discovering other solar systems, as people have, I've made that an interesting hobby of mine. So coming back to looking after our own planet, and this is where the environmental issues come in, I think we are stressing Gaia, we're stressing the natural homeostasis of the planet Earth with its biota, a living planet. We're stressing it by two things: overpopulating, increasing the amount we're taking by overpopulation, and removing the sorts of things which are natural in the environment, which reduce the greenhouse gases and so on, by deforestation, by monocultures, by reducing biodiversity. So to me, these issues of environment are very important, and we're stressing it.
One other question I've got to ask: how your intellectual lives work together at home? I think you've got one main study there. Do you?
Olga's got her.
You've got where you have a separate workspaces and.
Yes, we have. Actually, in a four-roomed house, we've got three studies. In theory, mine is the one which looks onto the street, so that I can keep my anthropological interest in the street. And then Victor has his office where the telephone is, and there's mine, which is largely swamped by photograph albums.
And are you really tolerant about the time each other spend in there, or do you?
The final equation is that having all of this space, we end up in this room, kitchen lounge business, and we sit at those very seats and we work independently. Or I work at the computer and Victor next to me. Basically, everything happens in this room together.
In the kitchen living room.
Yes. No, the studies are hoarders of
well, some well-stocked shelves there.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
But the production happens in here.
Yeah, more like libraries and...
Yes.
Yeah, the libraries. Yeah, yes. Resource areas.
Mm. Got this rather fatuous question about what gives you happiness or personal satisfaction. Well, I suppose all those things do.
I'd like to say that I've especially enjoyed the common travels that we've had, where our interests were stimulated and where we enjoyed each other's company and reacted to the environment, so be it several weeks to China, or be it travels through North America, camping with the children from 11,000 miles from San Diego north along the Pacific coast and across to the Ottawa and the east coast of North America, with them by the Great Lakes and Grand Tetons and all that. So we've had those family outings together with the children as well as they were growing, and after that other travels. Lots of travels in Southern Africa, South Africa especially, and to me they've been the highlights. But also because we've attended each other's interests in conferences. Now, Olga has attended conferences of some geology, but geomorphology, and
rock art.
Rock art was another one where by joint interests, myself on more geological side and dating side, Olga on her own side. So these sort of expeditions, these sort of trips where we have indulged in interests which are mutual. And I would say too that since Olga did the amazing amount of study with the environmental studies, it opened up her eyes and ears to the jargon that we use, the millions of years and all the terminologies that geologists use, and we were able to converse across that divide. I was also able to, my own interests have shifted towards the latest geological events and catastrophes of huge volcanic eruptions, Santorini and Atlantis and whatever else is around, to show the interaction with humanity and human history and geological events. So in some sense they've been together. I think we're both looking forward to someday travelling to southwestern France to look at the cave areas of early human, kind of interest in that.
Yeah, but I would like to reflect on that, because you asked about happiness and what makes it. I have a completely different focus to Victor. I'm interested to hear this catalogue of past travel. To me, this is very much the past, and it makes me wonder the room in which you sleep with all those photograph albums. My reflection at this stage is very different. It's not reflections on the past, but reflecting, not even thinking about those things, so they're very far. But the happiness is in this terminal stage, because it is nothing else but terminal at our age, past 70, this last season, as it were, and an absolute winding down. I don't have this, the world is there for to conquer. I think, hey, there is so much more that I haven't seen and so on, and I'm not in the least hungry, in a way, to see it, because I have such satisfaction in pay back to society now. It's a completely different approach. I'm closing down, and in closing down, there's an anxiousness to pay back. And payback means the volunteering, it means teaching English where it's needed, it means looking after the grandkids, it means smoothing over where things have to be smoothed over, and you go and smooth it over. It may have no outcomes, it may have nothing at all, but what one has built on and gleaned from years past gives one a sort of, perhaps I wouldn't dare to say understanding, but a facility or a boldness to engage with issues that you mightn't have at a younger age.
That was the conclusion of our interview with Vic and Olga Gostin. Many thanks to Doug McCann for participating. The discussion actually continued on in the evening when those birds out the back door had finally gone to sleep. Well, I'm still thinking about some new In My Study notes, but many thanks to all those out there who download my ramblings. I hope they at least provoke some worthwhile discussion. Music in this program was my usual theme, the Bach Prelude, played by Ronald Farren Price, courtesy of Move Records. Full details on the study website. And so, until next time, it's Shut the Door and Reading Lamp Only in the Study.